Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Chapter 17 of The House of the Seven Gables. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain and is read by Mark Smith. The House of the Seven Gables by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Chapter 17. The Flight of Two Owls. Summer as it was, the east wind set poor Hepzibah's few remaining teeth chattering in her head as she and Clifford faced it on their way up Pynchon Street and towards the center of the town. Not merely was it the shiver which this pitiless blast brought to her frame, although her feet and hands especially had never seemed so death a cold as now. But there was a moral sensation, mingling itself with the physical chill, and causing her to shake more in spirit than in body. The world's broad, bleak atmosphere was all so comfortless. Such, indeed, is the impression which it makes on every new adventurer, even if he plunge into it while the warmest tide of life is bubbling through his veins. What, then, must it have been to Hepzibah and Clifford, so time-stricken as they were, yet so like children in their inexperience, as they left the doorstep and passed from beneath the wide shelter of the Pynchon Elm? They were wandering all abroad, on precisely such a pilgrimage as a child often meditates, to the world's end, with perhaps a sixpence and a biscuit in his pocket. In Hepzibah's mind, there was the wretched consciousness of being adrift. She had lost the faculty of self-guidance, but, in view of the difficulties around her, felt it hardly worth an effort to regain it, and was, moreover, incapable of making one. As they proceeded on their strange expedition, she now and then cast a look sidelong at Clifford, and could not but observe that he was possessed and swayed by a powerful excitement. It was this, indeed, that gave him the control which he had at once, and so irresistibly established over his movements. It not a little resembled the exhilaration of wine, or it might more fancifully be compared to a joyous piece of music, played with wild vivacity, but upon a disordered instrument. As the cracked, jarring note might always be heard, and as it jarred loudest amidst the loftiest exultation of the melody, so was there a continual quake through Clifford, causing him most to quiver when he wore a triumphant smile, and seemed almost under a necessity to skip in his gait. They met few people abroad, even on passing from the retired neighborhood of the House of the Seven Gables, into what was ordinarily the more thronged and busier portion of the town. Glistening sidewalks, with little pools of rain here and there along their unequal surface, umbrellas displayed ostentatiously in the shop windows, as if the life of trade had concentrated itself in that one article. Wet leaves of the horse-chestnut or elm trees, torn off untimely by the blast and scattered along the public way, an unsightly accumulation of mud in the middle of the street, which perversely grew the more unclean for its long and laborious washing. These were the more definable points of a very somber picture. In the way of movement and human life, there was the hasty rattle of a cab or coach, its driver protected by a waterproof cap over his head and shoulders. The forlorn figure of an old man, who seemed to have crept out of some subterranean sewer, and was stooping along the kennel and poking the wet rubbish with a stick in quest of rusty nails. A merchant or two, at the door of the post office, together with an editor and a miscellaneous politician, awaiting a dilatory mail. A few visages of retired sea captains at the window of an insurance office, looking out vacantly at the vacant street, blaspheming at the weather, and fretting at the dearth as well of public news as local gossip. What a treasure trove to these venerable quidnuncs could they have guessed the secret which Hepzibah and Clifford were carrying along with them! But their two figures attracted hardly so much notice as that of a young girl, who passed at the same instant, and happened to raise her skirt a trifle too high above her ankles. Had it been a sunny and cheerful day, they could hardly have gone through the streets without making themselves obnoxious to remark. Now, probably, they were felt to be in keeping with the dismal and bitter weather, and therefore did not stand out in strong relief, as if the sun were shining on them, but melted into the gray gloom and were forgotten as soon as gone. Poor Hepzibah! Could she have understood this fact, it would have brought her some little comfort, for, to all her other troubles, strange to say, there was added the womanish and old maiden-like misery arising from a sense of unseemliness in her attire. Thus she was fain to shrink deeper into herself, as it were, as if in the hope of making people suppose that here was only a cloak and hood, threadbare and woefully faded, taking an airing in the midst of the storm without any wearer. As they went on, the feeling of indistinctness and unreality kept dimly hovering round about her, and so diffusing itself into her system that one of her hands was hardly palpable to the touch of the other. Any certainty would have been preferable to this. She whispered to herself again and again, "Am I awake? Am I awake?" and sometimes exposed her face to the chill spatter of the wind, for the sake of its rude assurance that she was. Whether it was Clifford's purpose, or only chance, had led them thither, they now found themselves passing beneath the arched entrance of a large structure of gray stone. Within there was a spacious breadth, and an airy height from floor to roof, now partially filled with smoke and steam, which eddied voluminously upward and formed a mimic cloud region over their heads. A train of cars was just ready for a start. The locomotive was fretting and fuming, like a steed impatient for a headlong rush, and the bell rang out its hasty peal, so well expressing the brief summons which life vouchsafes to us in its hurried career. Without question or delay, with the irresistible decision, if not rather to be called recklessness, which had so strangely taken possession of him, and through him of Hepzibah, Clifford impelled her towards the cars and assisted her to enter. The signal was given, the engine puffed forth its short, quick breaths, the train began its movement, and, along with 100 other passengers, these two unwonted travelers sped onward like the wind. At last, therefore, and after so long estrangement from everything that the world acted or enjoyed, they had been drawn into the great current of human life, and were swept away with it, as by the suction of fate itself. Still haunted with the idea that not one of the past incidents, inclusive of Judge Pyncheon's visit, could be real, the recluse of the Seven Gables murmured in her brother's ear,
"Clifford, Clifford, is not this a dream?"
"A dream, Hepzibah," repeated he, almost laughing in her face. "On the contrary, I have never been awake before."
Meanwhile, looking from the window, they could see the world racing past them. At one moment, they were rattling through a solitude, the next, a village had grown up around them. A few breaths more, and it had vanished, as if swallowed by an earthquake. The spires of meeting-houses seemed set adrift from their foundations. The broad-based hills glided away. Everything was unfixed from its age-long rest, and moving at whirlwind speed in a direction opposite to their own. Within the car there was the usual interior life of the railroad, offering little to the observation of other passengers, but full of novelty for this pair of strangely enfranchised prisoners. It was novelty enough, indeed, that there were 50 human beings in close relation with them, under one long and narrow roof, and drawn onward by the same mighty influence that had taken their two selves into its grasp. It seemed marvelous how all these people could remain so quietly in their seats, while so much noisy strength was at work in their behalf. Some, with tickets in their hats, long travelers these, before whom lay 100 miles of railroad, had plunged into the English scenery and adventures of pamphlet novels, and were keeping company with dukes and earls. Others, whose briefer span forbade their devoting themselves to studies so abstruse, beguiled the little tedium of the way with penny papers. A party of girls, and one young man, on opposite sides of the car, found huge amusement in a game of ball. They tossed it to and fro with peals of laughter that might be measured by mile lengths. For, faster than the nimble ball could fly, the merry players fled unconsciously along, leaving the trail of their mirth afar behind, and ending their game under another sky than had witnessed its commencement. Boys, with apples, cakes, candy, and rolls of variously tinctured lozenges, merchandise that reminded Hepzibah of her deserted shop, appeared at each momentary stopping-place, doing up their business in a hurry, or breaking it short off, lest the market should ravish them away with it. New people continually entered. Old acquaintances, for such they soon grew to be in this rapid current of affairs, continually departed. Here and there, amid the rumble and the tumult, sat one asleep. Sleep, sport, business, graver or lighter study, and the common and inevitable movement onward. It was life itself. Clifford's naturally poignant sympathies were all aroused. He caught the color of what was passing about him, and threw it back more vividly than he received it, but mixed, nevertheless, with a lurid and portentous hue. Hepzibah, on the other hand, felt herself more apart from humankind than even in the seclusion which she had just quitted.
"You are not happy, Hepzibah," said Clifford apart in a tone of reproach. "You are thinking of that dismal old house and of Cousin Jaffrey."
Here came the quake through him.
"And of Cousin Jaffrey sitting there all by himself. Take my advice, follow my example, and let such things slip aside. Here we are in the world, Hepzibah, in the midst of life, in the throng of our fellow beings. Let you and I be happy, as happy as that youth and those pretty girls at their game of ball."
"Happy,"
thought Hepzibah, bitterly conscious at the word of her dull and heavy heart, with the frozen pain in it.
"Happy. He is mad already, and if I could once feel myself broad awake, I should go mad too."
If a fixed idea be madness, she was perhaps not remote from it. Fast and far as they had rattled and clattered along the iron track, they might just as well, as regarded Hepzibah's mental images, have been passing up and down Pyncheon Street. With miles and miles of varied scenery between, there was no scene for her save the 7 old gable peaks, with their moss and the tuft of weeds in one of the angles, and the shop window, and a customer shaking the door, and compelling the little bell to jingle fiercely, but without disturbing Judge Pyncheon. This one old house was everywhere. It transported its great lumbering bulk with more than railroad speed, and set itself phlegmatically down on whatever spot she glanced at. The quality of Hepzibah's mind was too unmalleable to take new impressions so readily as Clifford's. He had a winged nature. She was rather of the vegetable kind, and could hardly be kept long alive if drawn up by the roots. Thus it happened that the relation heretofore existing between her brother and herself was changed. At home, she was his guardian. Here, Clifford had become hers, and seemed to comprehend whatever belonged to their new position with a singular rapidity of intelligence. He had been startled into manhood and intellectual vigor, or, at least, into a condition that resembled them, though it might be both diseased and transitory. The conductor now applied for their tickets, and Clifford, who had made himself the purse-bearer, put a banknote into his hand, as he had observed others do.
"For the lady and yourself?" asked the conductor. "And how far?"
"As far as that will carry us," said Clifford. "It is no great matter. We are riding for pleasure, merely."
"You choose a strange day for it, sir,"
remarked a gimlet-eyed old gentleman on the other side of the car, looking at Clifford and his companion, as if curious to make them out.
"The best chance of pleasure in an easterly rain, I take it, is in a man's own house, with a nice little fire in the chimney."
"I cannot precisely agree with you," said Clifford, courteously bowing to the old gentleman,
and at once taking up the clue of conversation which the latter had proffered.
"It had just occurred to me, on the contrary, that this admirable invention of the railroad, with the vast and inevitable improvements to be looked for, both as to speed and convenience, is destined to do away with those stale ideas of home and fireside, and substitute something better."
"In the name of common sense," asked the old gentleman rather testily, "what can be better for a man than his own parlour and chimney-corner?"
"These things have not the merit which many good people attribute to them," replied Clifford. "They may be said, in few and pithy words, to have ill-served a poor purpose. My impression is that our wonderfully increased and still increasing facilities of locomotion are destined to bring us around again to the nomadic state. You are aware, my dear sir, you must have observed it in your own experience, that all human progress is in a circle, or, to use a more accurate and beautiful figure, in an ascending spiral curve. While we fancy ourselves going straight forward and attaining, at every step, an entirely new position of affairs, we do actually return to something long ago tried and abandoned, but which we now find etherealized, refined, and perfected to its ideal. The past is but a coarse and sensual prophecy of the present and the future. To apply this truth to the topic now under discussion, in the early epochs of our race, men dwelt in temporary huts of bowers of branches, as easily constructed as a bird's nest, and which they built, if it should be called building, when such sweet homes of a summer solstice rather grew than were made with hands, which nature, we shall say, assisted them to rear where fruit abounded, where fish and game were plentiful, or most especially, where the sense of beauty was to be gratified by a lovelier shade than elsewhere, and a more exquisite arrangement of lake, wood, and hill. This life possessed a charm which, ever since man quitted it, has vanished from existence. And it typified something better than itself. It had its drawbacks, such as hunger and thirst, inclement weather, hot sunshine, and weary and foot-blistering marches over barren and ugly tracks that lay between the sites desirable for their fertility and beauty. But in our ascending spiral we escape all this. These railroads, could but the whistle be made musical, and the rumble and the jar got rid of, are positively the greatest blessing that the ages have wrought out for us. They give us wings. They annihilate the toil and dust of pilgrimage. They spiritualize travel. Transition being so facile, what can be any man's inducement to tarry in one spot? Why,
Therefore, should he build a more cumbrous habitation than can readily be carried off with him? Why should he make himself a prisoner for life in brick and stone and old worm-eaten timber, when he may just as easily dwell, in one sense, nowhere, in a better sense, wherever the fit and beautiful shall offer him a home? Clifford's countenance glowed as he divulged this theory. A youthful character shone out from within, converting the wrinkles and pallid duskiness of age into an almost transparent mask. The merry girls let their ball drop upon the floor and gazed at him. They said to themselves, perhaps, that before his hair was gray and the crow's feet tracked his temples, this now decaying man must have stamped the impress of his features on many a woman's heart. But alas, no woman's eye had seen his face while it was beautiful.
"I should scarcely call it an improved state of things," observed Clifford's new acquaintance, "to live everywhere and nowhere."
"Would you not?" exclaimed Clifford with singular energy. "It is as clear to me as sunshine, were there any in the sky, that the greatest possible stumbling-blocks in the path of human happiness and improvement are these heaps of bricks and stones, consolidated with mortar or hewn timber, fastened together with spike-nails, which men painfully contrive for their own torment, and call them house and home. The soul needs air, a wide sweep and frequent change of it. Morbid influences in a thousandfold variety gather about hearths and pollute the life of households. There is no such unwholesome atmosphere as that of an old home, rendered poisonous by one's defunct forefathers and relatives. I speak of what I know. There is a certain house within my familiar recollection, one of those peaked gable, there are seven of them, projecting storied edifices, such as you occasionally see in our older towns, a rusty, crazy, creaky, dry-rotted, dingy, dark, and miserable old dungeon, with an arched window over the porch, and a little shop-door on one side, and a great melancholy elm before it. Now, sir, whenever my thoughts recur to this seven-gabled mansion, the fact is so very curious that I must needs mention it. Immediately I have a vision or image of an elderly man, of remarkably stern countenance, sitting in an oaken elbow-chair, dead, stone-dead, with an ugly flow of blood upon his shirt-bosom, dead but with open eyes. He taints the whole house, as I remember it. I could never flourish there, nor be happy, nor do nor enjoy what God meant me to do and enjoy. His face darkened and seemed to contract, and shrivel itself up, and wither into age. "Never, sir," he repeated. "I could never draw cheerful breath there."
"I should think not," said the old gentleman, eyeing Clifford earnestly, and rather apprehensively. "I should conceive not, sir, with that notion in your head."
"Surely not," continued Clifford. "And it were a relief to me if that house could be torn down or burnt up, and so the earth be rid of it, and grass be sown abundantly over its foundation. Not that I should ever visit its site again. For, sir, the farther I get away from it, the more does the joy, the lightsome freshness, the heart-leap, the intellectual dance, the youth, in short, yes, my youth, the more does it come back to me. No longer ago than this morning, I was old. I remember looking in the glass and wondering at my own gray hair, and the wrinkles, many and deep, right across my brow, and the furrows down my cheeks, and the prodigious trampling of crow's feet about my temples. It was too soon. I could not bear it. Age had no right to come. I had not lived. But now, do I look old? If so, my aspect belies me strangely, for, A great weight being off my mind, I feel in the very heyday of my youth, with the world and my best days before me."
"I trust you may find it so," said the old gentleman, who seemed rather embarrassed, and desirous of avoiding the observation which Clifford's wild talk drew on them both. "You have my best wishes for it."
"For heaven's sake, dear Clifford, be quiet," whispered his sister. "They think you mad."
"Be quiet yourself, Hepzibah," returned her brother. "No matter what they think, I am not mad. For the first time in 30 years, my thoughts gush up and find words ready for them. I must talk, and I will." He turned again towards the old gentleman, and renewed the conversation. "Yes, my dear sir," said he, "it is my firm belief and hope that these terms of roof and hearthstone, which have so long been held to embody something sacred, are soon to pass out of men's daily use and be forgotten. Just imagine, for a moment, how much of human evil will crumble away with this one change. What we call real estate, the solid ground to build a house on, is the broad foundation on which nearly all the guilt of this world rests. A man will commit almost any wrong. He will heap up an immense pile of wickedness as hard as granite, and which will weigh as heavily upon his soul to eternal ages, only to build a great, gloomy, dark-chambered mansion for himself to die in, and for his posterity to be miserable in. He lays his own dead corpse beneath the underpinning, as one may say, and hangs his frowning picture on the wall, and after thus converting himself into an evil destiny, expects his remotest great-grandchildren to be happy there. I do not speak wildly. I have just such a house in my mind's eye."
"Then, sir," said the old gentleman, getting anxious to drop the subject, "you are not to blame for leaving it."
"Within the lifetime of the child already born," Clifford went on, "all this will be done away. The world is growing too ethereal and spiritual to bear these enormities a great while longer. To me, though, for a considerable period of time, I have lived chiefly in retirement, and no less of such things than most men. Even to me, the harbingers of a better era are unmistakable. Mesmerism, now! Will that effect nothing, think you, towards purging away the grossness out of human life?"
"All a humbug," growled the old gentleman.
"These rapping spirits that little Phoebe told us of the other day," said Clifford, "what are these but the messengers of the spiritual world, knocking at the door of substance, and it shall be flung wide open?"
"A humbug again!"
cried the old gentleman, growing more and more testy at these glimpses of Clifford's metaphysics.
"I should like to rap with a good stick on the empty pates of the dolts who circulate such nonsense."
"Then there is electricity, the demon, the angel, the mighty physical power, the all-pervading intelligence!" exclaimed Clifford. "Is that a humbug, too? Is it a fact, or have I dreamt it, that by means of electricity the world of matter has become a great nerve, vibrating thousands of miles in a breathless point of time? Rather, the round globe is a vast head, a brain, instinct with intelligence. Or shall we say, it is itself a thought, nothing but thought, and no longer the substance which we deemed it?"
"If you mean the telegraph,"
said the old gentleman, glancing his eye towards its wire alongside the rail track,
"it is an excellent thing. That is, of course, if the speculators in cotton and politics don't get possession of it. A great thing indeed, sir, particularly as regards the detection of bank robbers and murderers."
"I don't quite like it in that point of view," replied Clifford. "A bank robber, and what you call a murderer, likewise has his rights, which men of enlightened humanity and conscience should regard in so much the more liberal spirit. because the bulk of society is prone to controvert their existence. An almost spiritual medium, like the electric telegraph, should be consecrated to high, deep, joyful, and holy missions. Lovers, day by day, hour by hour, if so often moved to do it, might send their heart-throbs from Maine to Florida, with some such words as these: I love you forever. My heart runs over with love. I love you more than I can. And again at the next message, I have lived an hour longer and love you twice as much. Or, when a good man has departed, his distant friend should be conscious of an electric thrill, as from the world of happy spirits, telling him, Your dear friend is in bliss. Or to an absent husband should come tidings thus: An immortal being, of whom you are the father, has this moment come from God. And immediately its little voice would seem to have reached so far, and to be echoing in his heart. But for these poor rogues, the bank robbers, who, after all, are about as honest as 9 people in 10, except that they disregard certain formalities, and prefer to transact business at midnight rather than change hours. And for these murderers, as you phrase it, who are often excusable in the motives of their deed, and deserve to be ranked among public benefactors, if we consider only its result. For unfortunate individuals like these, I really cannot applaud the enlistment of an immaterial and miraculous power in the universal world-hunt at their heels.
You can't, hey?
Cried the old gentleman with a hard look. Positively no, answered Clifford. It puts them too miserably at disadvantage. For example, sir, in a dark, low, cross-beamed, panelled room of an old house, let us suppose a dead man sitting in an armchair, with a blood-stain on his shirt-bosom, and let us add to our hypothesis another man, issuing from the house, which he feels to be overfilled with the dead man's presence, and let us lastly imagine him fleeing, heaven knows whither, at the speed of a hurricane, by railroad. Now, sir, if the fugitive alight in some distant town, and find all the people babbling about that self-same dead man, whom he has fled so far to avoid the sight and thought of, will you not allow that his natural rights have been infringed? He has been deprived of his city of refuge, and, in my humble opinion, has suffered infinite wrong.
You are a strange man, sir, said the old gentleman, bringing his gimlet eye to a point on Clifford, as if determined to bore right into him. I can't see through you.
No, I'll be bound you can't, cried Clifford, laughing. And yet, my dear sir, I am as transparent as the water of Maul's well. But come, Hepzibah, we have flown far enough for once. Let us alight, as the birds do, and perch ourselves on the nearest twig, and consult whither we shall fly next. Just then, as it happened, the train reached the solitary way-station. Taking advantage of the brief pause, Clifford left the car and drew Hepzibah along with him. A moment afterwards, the train, with all the life of its interior, amid which Clifford had made himself so conspicuous an object, was gliding away in the distance and rapidly lessening to a point which, in another moment, vanished. The world had fled away from these two wanderers. They gazed drearily about them. At a little distance stood a wooden church, black with age, and in a dismal state of ruin and decay, with broken windows, a great rift through the main body of the edifice, and a rafter dangling from the top of the square tower. Farther off was a farmhouse in the old style, as venerably black as the church, with a roof sloping downward from the 3-story peak to within a man's height of the ground. It seemed uninhabited. There were the relics of a woodpile, indeed, near the door, but with grass sprouting up among the chips and scattered logs. The small raindrops came down aslant. The wind was not turbulent, but sullen, and full of chilly moisture. Clifford shivered from head to foot.
the wild effervescence of his mood, which had so readily supplied thoughts, fantasies, and a strange aptitude of words, and impelled him to talk from the mere necessity of giving vent to this bubbling-up gush of ideas, had entirely subsided. A powerful excitement had given him energy and vivacity. Its operation over, he forthwith began to sink.
"You must take the lead now, Hepzibah," murmured he with a torpid and reluctant utterance. "Do with me as you will."
She knelt down upon the platform where they were standing and lifted her clasped hands to the sky. The dull, gray weight of clouds made it invisible, but it was no hour for disbelief, no juncture this to question that there was a sky above, and an Almighty Father looking from it.
"O God!"
ejaculated poor, gaunt Hepzibah, then paused a moment to consider what her prayer should be.
"O God! Our Father, are we not thy children? Have mercy on us."
End of chapter. Chapter 18 of The House of the Seven Gables. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain and is read by Mark Smith of Simpsonville, South Carolina. The House of the Seven Gables by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Chapter 18. Governor Pyncheon. Judge Pyncheon, while his two relatives had fled away with such ill-considered haste, still sits in the old parlor, keeping house, as the familiar phrase is, in the absence of his ordinary occupants. To him, and to the venerable House of the Seven Gables, does our story now betake itself, like an owl, bewildered in the daylight, and hastening back to its hollow tree. The judge has not shifted his position for a long while now. He has not stirred hand or foot, nor withdrawn his eyes so much as a hair's breadth from their fixed gaze towards the corner of the room, since the footsteps of Hepzibah and Clifford creaked along the passage, and the outer door was closed cautiously behind their exit. He holds his watch in his left hand, but clutched in such a manner that you cannot see the dial-plate. How profound a fit of meditation! Or, supposing him asleep, how infantile a quietude of conscience, and that wholesome order in the gastric region, are betokened by slumber so entirely undisturbed with starts, cramp, twitches, muttered dream-talk, trumpet blast through the nasal organ, or any slightest irregularity of breath. You must hold your own breath to satisfy yourself whether he breathes at all. It is quite inaudible. You hear the ticking of his watch. His breath you do not hear. A most refreshing slumber, doubtless. And yet the judge cannot be asleep. His eyes are open. A veteran politician, such as he, would never fall asleep with wide-open eyes, lest some enemy or mischief-maker, taking him thus at unawares, should peep through these windows into his consciousness, and make strange discoveries among the reminiscences, projects, hopes, apprehensions, weaknesses, and strong points, which he has heretofore shared with nobody. A cautious man is proverbially said to sleep with one eye open. That may be wisdom, but not with both, for this were heedlessness. No, no, Judge Pyncheon cannot be asleep. It is odd, however, that a gentleman so burdened with engagements, and noted too for punctuality, should linger thus in an old lonely mansion, which he has never seemed very fond of visiting. The oaken chair, to be sure, may tempt him with its roominess. It is indeed a spacious, and, allowing for the rude age that fashioned it, a moderately easy seat, with capacity enough at all events, and offering no restraint to the judge's breadth of beam. A bigger man might find ample accommodation in it. His ancestor, now pictured upon the wall, with all his English beef about him, used hardly to present a front extending from elbow to elbow of this chair, or a base that would cover its whole cushion. But there are better chairs than this—mahogany, black walnut,
rosewood, spring-seated and damask-cushioned, with varied slopes, and innumerable artifices to make them easy, and obviate the irksomeness of too tame an ease. A score of such might be at Judge Pyncheon's service. Yes, in a score of drawing-rooms he would be more than welcome. Mamma would advance to meet him with outstretched hand. The virgin daughter, elderly as he has now got to be, an old widower, as he smilingly describes himself, would shake up the cushion for the judge, and do her pretty utmost to make him comfortable. For the judge is a prosperous man. He cherishes his schemes, moreover, like other people, and reasonably brighter than most others, or did so, at least, as he lay abed this morning, in an agreeable half-drowse, planning the business of the day, and speculating on the probabilities of the next 15 years. With his firm health, and the little inroad that age has made upon him, 15 years, or 20, yes, or perhaps 25, are no more than he may fairly call his own. 25 years for the enjoyment of this real estate in town and country, his railroad, bank, and insurance shares, his United States stock, his wealth, in short, however invested, now in possession or soon to be acquired, together with the public honors that have fallen upon him and the weightier ones that are yet to fall. It is good. It is excellent. It is enough. Still lingering in the old chair, if the judge has a little time to throw away, why does he not visit the insurance office, as is his frequent custom, and sit a while in one of their leather-cushioned armchairs, listening to the gossip of the day and dropping some deeply designed chance word, which will be certain to become the gossip of tomorrow? And have not the bank directors a meeting at which it was the judge's purpose to be present, and his office to preside? Indeed they have, and the hour is noted on a card, which is, or ought to be, in Judge Pyncheon's right vest pocket. Let him go thither and loll at ease upon his money-bags. He has lounged long enough in the old chair. This was to have been such a busy day. In the first place, the interview with Clifford, half an hour by the judge's reckoning, was to suffice for that. It would probably be less. But, taking into consideration that Hepzibah was first to be dealt with, and that these women are apt to make many words where a few would do much better, it might be safest to allow half an hour. Half an hour? Why, Judge, it is already 2 hours by your own undeviatingly accurate chronometer. Glance your eye down at it and see. Ah, he will not give himself the trouble either to bend his head or elevate his hand so as to bring the faithful timekeeper within his range of vision. Time, all at once, appears to have become a matter of no moment with the judge. And has he forgotten all the other items of his memoranda? Clifford's affair arranged, he was to meet a State Street broker, who has undertaken to procure a heavy percentage, and the best of paper, for a few loose thousands which the judge happens to have by him, uninvested. The wrinkled note-shaver will have taken his railroad trip in vain. Half an hour later, in the street next to this, there was to be an auction of real estate, including a portion of the old Pyncheon property, originally belonging to Maul's garden ground. It has been alienated from the Pyncheons these 40 years, but the judge had kept it in his eye, and had set his heart on re-annexing it to the small domain still left around the Seven Gables. And now, during this odd fit of oblivion, the fatal hammer must have fallen, and transferred our ancient patrimony to some alien possessor. Possibly, indeed, the sale may have been postponed till fairer weather. If so, will the judge make it convenient to be present, and favor the auctioneer with his bid, on the proximate occasion? The next affair was to buy a horse for his own driving. The one heretofore his favorite stumbled, this very morning, on the road to town, and must be at once discarded. Judge Pyncheon's neck is too precious to be risked on such a contingency as a stumbling steed. should all the above business be seasonably got through with, he might attend the meeting of a charitable society, the very name of which, however, in the multiplicity of his benevolence, is quite forgotten, so that this engagement may pass unfulfilled, and no great harm done. And if he have time, amid the press of more urgent matters, he must take measures for the renewal of Mrs. Pyncheon's tombstone, which the sexton tells him has fallen on its marble face and is cracked quite in twain. She was a praiseworthy woman enough, thinks the judge, in spite of her nervousness and the tears that she was so oozy with, and her foolish behavior about the coffee, and as she took her departure so seasonably, he will not grudge the second tombstone. It is better, at least, than if she had never needed any. The next item on his list was to give orders for some fruit trees, of a rare variety, to be deliverable at his country seat in the ensuing autumn. Yes, buy them, by all means, and may the peaches be luscious in your mouth, Judge Pyncheon. After this comes something more important. A committee of his political party has besought him for $100 or $200, in addition to his previous disbursements, towards carrying on the fall campaign. The judge is a patriot. The fate of the country is staked on the November election, and besides, as will be shadowed forth in another paragraph, he has no trifling stake of his own in the same great game. He will do what the committee asks. Nay, he will be liberal beyond their expectations. They shall have a check for $500, and more anon, if it be needed. What next? A decayed widow, whose husband was Judge Pyncheon's early friend, has laid her case of destitution before him in a very moving letter. She and her fair daughter have scarcely bread to eat. He partly intends to call on her today, perhaps so, perhaps not, accordingly as he may happen to have leisure, or a small bank note. Another business which, however, he puts no great weight on. It is well, you know, to be heedful, but not over-anxious, as respects one's personal health. Another business, then, was to consult his family physician. About what, for heaven's sake? Why, it is rather difficult to describe the symptoms. A mere dimness of sight and dizziness of brain, was it? Or disagreeable choking, or stifling, or gurgling, or bubbling in the region of the thorax, as the anatomists say? Or was it a pretty severe throbbing and kicking of the heart, rather creditable to him than otherwise, as showing that the organ had not been left out of the judge's physical contrivance? No matter what it was, the doctor probably would smile at the statement of such trifles to his professional ear. The judge would smile in his turn, and meeting one another's eyes, they would enjoy a hearty laugh together. But a fig for medical advice. The judge will never need it. Pray, pray, Judge Pyncheon, look at your watch, now. What, not a glance? It is within 10 minutes of the dinner hour. It surely cannot have slipped your memory that the dinner of today is to be the most important in its consequences of all the dinners you ever ate. Yes, precisely the most important, although in the course of your somewhat eminent career you have been placed high towards the head of the table at splendid banquets and have poured out your festive eloquence to ears yet echoing with Webster's mighty organ tones. No public dinner this, however. It is merely a gathering of some dozen or so of friends from several districts of the state. Men of distinguished character and influence, assembling, almost casually, at the house of a common friend, likewise distinguished, who will make them welcome to a little better than his ordinary fare. Nothing in the way of French cookery, but an excellent dinner, nevertheless. Real turtle, we understand, and salmon, totog, canvasbacks, pig, English mutton, good roast beef, or dainties of that serious kind, fit for substantial country gentlemen, as these honorable persons mostly are. The delicacies of the season, in short,
and flavored by a brand of old Madeira which had been the pride of many seasons. It is the Juno brand, a glorious wine, fragrant and full of gentle might, a bottled-up happiness, put by for use, a golden liquid, worth more than liquid gold, so rare and admirable that veteran wine-bibbers counted among their epochs to have tasted it. It drives away the heartache, and substitutes no headache. Could the judge but quaff a glass, it might enable him to shake off the unaccountable lethargy which, for the 10 intervening minutes, and 5 to boot, are already past, has made him such a laggard at this momentous dinner. It would all but revive a dead man. Would you like to sip it now, Judge Pyncheon? Alas, this dinner! Have you really forgotten its true object? Then let us whisper it, that you may start at once out of the oaken chair, which really seems to be enchanted, like the one in Comus, or that in which Moll Pitcher imprisoned your own grandfather. But ambition is a talisman more powerful than witchcraft. Start up, then, and hurrying through the streets, burst in upon the company, that they may begin before the fish is spoiled. They wait for you, and it is little for your interest that they should wait. These gentlemen, need you be told it, have assembled, not without purpose, from every quarter of the state. They are practiced politicians, every man of them, and skilled to adjust those preliminary measures which steal from the people, without its knowledge, the power of choosing its own rulers. The popular voice, at the next gubernatorial election, though loud as thunder, will be really but an echo of what these gentlemen shall speak, under their breath, at your friend's festive board. They meet to decide upon their candidate. This little knot of subtle schemers will control the convention, and through it dictate to the party. And what worthier candidate, more wise and learned, more noted for philanthropic liberality, truer to safe principles, tried oftener by public trusts, more spotless in private character, with a larger stake in the common welfare, and deeper grounded, by hereditary descent, in the faith and practice of the Puritans, what man can be presented for the suffrage of the people, so eminently combining all these claims to the chief rulership, as Judge Pyncheon here before us? Make haste, then. Do your part. The mead for which you have toiled and fought and climbed and crept is ready for your grasp. Be present at this dinner. Drink a glass or two of that noble wine. Make your pledges in as low a whisper as you will, and you will rise up from table virtually governor of the glorious old state, Governor Pyncheon of Massachusetts. And is there no potent and exhilarating cordial in a certainty like this? It has been the grand purpose of half your lifetime to obtain it. Now, when there needs little more than to signify your acceptance, why do you sit there so lumpishly in your great-great-grandfather's oaken chair, as if preferring it to the gubernatorial one? We have all heard of King Log, but in these jostling times one of that royal kindred will hardly win the race for an elective chief magistracy. Well, it is absolutely too late for dinner. Turtle, salmon, toad-tog, woodcock, boiled turkey, south-down mutton, pig, roast beef, have vanished, or exist only in fragments, with lukewarm potatoes, and gravies crusted over with cold fat. The judge, had he done nothing else, would have achieved wonders with his knife and fork. It was he, you know, of whom it used to be said, in reference to his ogre-like appetite, that his creator made him a great animal, but that the dinner hour made him a great beast. Persons of his large sensual endowments must claim indulgence at their feeding time. But for once the judge is entirely too late for dinner. Too late, we fear, even to join the party at their wine. The guests are warm and merry. They have given up the judge. And concluding that the free soilers have him, they will fix upon another candidate. Were our friend now to stalk in among them with that wide-open stare, at once wild and stolid, his ungenial presence would be apt to change their cheer. Neither would it be seemly in Judge Pyncheon, generally so scrupulous in his attire, to show himself at a dinner-table with that crimson stain upon his shirt-bosom. By the by, how came it there? It is an ugly sight, at any rate, and the wisest way is for the judge to button his coat closely over his breast, and taking his horse and chaise from the livery-stable, to make all speed to his own house. There, after a glass of brandy and water, and a mutton-chop, a beefsteak, a broiled fowl, or some such hasty little dinner and supper all in one, he had better spend the evening by the fireside. He must toast his slippers a long while, in order to get rid of the chilliness which the air of this vile old house has sent curdling through his veins. Up, therefore, Judge Pyncheon, up! You have lost a day, but tomorrow will be here anon. Will you rise betimes and make the most of it? Tomorrow, tomorrow, tomorrow. We that are alive may rise betimes tomorrow. As for him that has died today, his morrow will be the resurrection morn. Meanwhile, the twilight is glooming upward out of the corners of the room. The shadows of the tall furniture grow deeper, and at first become more definite. Then, spreading wider, they lose their distinctness of outline in the dark gray tide of oblivion, as it were, that creeps slowly over the various objects, and the one human figure sitting in the midst of them. The gloom has not entered from without, it has brooded here all day, and now, taking its own inevitable time, will possess itself of everything. The judge's face, indeed, rigid and singularly white, refuses to melt into this universal solvent. Fainter and fainter grows the light. It is as if another double handful of darkness had been scattered through the air. Now it is no longer gray, but sable. There is still a faint appearance at the window, neither a glow, nor a gleam, nor a glimmer. Any phrase of light would express something far brighter than this doubtful perception, or sense, rather, that there is a window there. Has it yet vanished? No. Yes. Not quite. And there is still the swarthy whiteness. We shall venture to marry these ill-agreeing words. The swarthy whiteness of Judge Pyncheon's face. The features are all gone. There is only the paleness of them left. And how looks it now? There is no window. There is no face. An infinite, inscrutable blackness has annihilated sight. Where is our universe? All crumbled away from us, and we, adrift in chaos, may hearken to the gusts of homeless wind that go sighing and murmuring about in quest of what was once a world. Is there no other sound? One other, and a fearful one. It is the ticking of the judge's watch, which, ever since Hepzibah left the room in search of Clifford, he has been holding in his hand. Be the cause what it may, this little, quiet, never-ceasing throb of time's pulse, repeating its small strokes with such busy regularity, in Judge Pyncheon's motionless hand, has an effect of terror, which we do not find in any other accompaniment of the scene. But listen! That puff of the breeze was louder. It had a tone unlike the dreary and sullen one which has bemoaned itself, and afflicted all mankind with miserable sympathy for 5 days past. The wind is veered about. It now comes boisterously from the northwest, and, taking hold of the aged framework of the Seven Gables, gives it a shake, like a wrestler that would try strength with his antagonist. Another and another sturdy tussle with the blast. The old house creaks again, and makes a vociferous but somewhat unintelligible bellowing in its sooty throat. The big flue, we mean, of its wide chimney, partly in complaint at the rude wind, but rather, as befits their century and a half of hostile intimacy, in tough defiance. A rumbling kind of a bluster roars behind the fireboard. A door has slammed above stairs. A window, perhaps, has been left open, or else is driven in by an unruly gust. It is not to be conceived beforehand what wonderful wind instruments are these old timber mansions, and how haunted with the strangest noises, which immediately begin to sing, and sigh, and sob, and shriek, and to smite with sledge-hammers, airy but ponderous, in some distant chamber, and to tread along the entries as with stately footsteps, and rustle up and down the staircase as with silks miraculously stiff. Whenever the gale catches the house with a window open and gets fairly into it. Would that we were not an attendant spirit here. It is too awful. This clamor of the wind through the lonely house, the judge's quietude as he sits invisible, and that pertinacious ticking of his watch. As regards Judge Pyncheon's invisibility, however, that matter will soon be remedied. The northwest wind has swept the sky clear. The window is distinctly seen. Through its panes, moreover, we dimly catch the sweep of the dark, clustering foliage outside, fluttering with a constant irregularity of movement, and letting in a peep of starlight, now here, now there. Oftener than any other object, these glimpses illuminate the judge's face. But here comes more effectual light. Observe that silvery dance upon the upper branches of the pear tree, and now a little lower, and now on the whole mass of boughs, while, with their shifting intricacies, the moonbeams fall aslant into the room. They play over the judge's figure and show that he is not stirred throughout the hours of darkness. They follow the shadows in changeful sport across his unchanging features. They gleam upon his watch. His grasp conceals the dial-plate, but we know that the faithful hands have met, for one of the city clocks tells midnight. A man of sturdy understanding, like Judge Pyncheon, cares no more for 12 o'clock at night than for the corresponding hour of noon. However just the parallel drawn, in some of the preceding pages, between his Puritan ancestor and himself, it fails in this point. The Pyncheon of 2 centuries ago, in common with most of his contemporaries, professed his full belief in spiritual ministrations, although reckoning them chiefly of a malignant character. The Pyncheon of tonight, who sits in yonder armchair, believes in no such nonsense. Such, at least, was his creed some few hours since. His hair will not bristle, therefore, at the stories which, in times when chimney-corners had benches in them, where old people sat poking into the ashes of the past, and raking out traditions like live coals, used to be told about this very room of his ancestral house. In fact, these tales are too absurd to bristle even childhood's hair. What sense, meaning, or moral, for example, such as even ghost stories should be susceptible of, can be traced in the ridiculous legend that at midnight all the dead Pyncheons are bound to assemble in this parlor. And pray, for what? Why, to see whether the portrait of their ancestor still keeps its place upon the wall, in compliance with his testamentary directions. Is it worthwhile to come out of their graves for that? We are tempted to make a little sport with the idea. Ghost stories are hardly to be treated seriously any longer. The family party of the defunct Pyncheons, we presume, goes off in this wise. First comes the ancestor himself, in his black coat, steeple hat, and trunk breeches, girt about the waist with a leathern belt, in which hangs his steel-hilted sword. He has a long staff in his hand, such as gentlemen in advanced life used to carry, as much for the dignity of the thing as for the support to be derived from it. He looks up at the portrait, a thing of no substance, gazing at its own painted image. All is safe. The picture is still there. The purpose of his brain has been kept sacred thus long after the man himself has sprouted up in graveyard grass. See? He lifts his ineffectual hand and tries the frame. All safe. But is that a smile? Is it not rather a frown of deadly import that darkens over the shadow of his features? The stout colonel is dissatisfied. So decided is his look of discontent as to impart additional distinctness to his features, through which, nevertheless, the moonlight passes and flickers on the wall beyond. Something has strangely vexed the ancestor. With a grim shake of the head, he turns away. Here comes other Pyncheons, the whole tribe, in their half a dozen generations, jostling and elbowing one another to reach the picture. We behold aged men and grandams, a clergyman with the puritanic stiffness still in his garb and mien, and a red-coated officer of the old French war. And there comes the shopkeeping Pyncheon of a century ago, with the ruffles turned back from his wrists. And there the periwigged and brocaded gentleman of the artist's legend, with the beautiful and pensive Alice, who brings no pride out of her virgin grave. All try the picture frame. What do these ghostly people seek? A mother lifts her child, that his little hands may touch it. There is evidently a mystery about the picture that perplexes these poor Pyncheons when they ought to be at rest. In a corner, meanwhile, stands the figure of an elderly man, in a leathern jerkin and breeches, with a carpenter's rule sticking out of his side pocket. He points his finger at the bearded colonel and his descendants, nodding, jeering, mocking, and finally bursting into obstreperous, though inaudible, laughter. Indulging our fancy in this freak, we have partly lost the power of restraint and guidance. We distinguished an unlooked-for figure in our visionary scene. Among those ancestral people there is a young man, dressed in the very fashion of today. He wears a dark frock-coat, almost destitute of skirts, gray pantaloons, gaiter boots of patent leather, and has a finely wrought gold chain across his breast, and a little silver-headed whalebone stick in his hand. Were we to meet this figure at noonday, we should greet him as young Jaffrey Pyncheon, the judge's only surviving child, who has been spending the last 2 years in foreign travel. If still in life, how comes his shadow hither? If dead, what a misfortune! The old Pyncheon property, together with the great estate acquired by the young man's father, would devolve on whom? On poor, foolish Clifford, gaunt Hepzibah, and rustic little Phoebe. But another and a greater marvel greets us. Can we believe our eyes? A stout, elderly gentleman has made his appearance. He has an aspect of eminent respectability, wears a black coat and pantaloons, of roomy width, and might be pronounced scrupulously neat in his attire, but for a broad crimson stain across his snowy neckcloth and down his shirt bosom. Is it the judge, or no? How can it be Judge Pyncheon? We discern his figure, as plainly as the flickering moonbeams can show us anything, still seated in the oaken chair. Be the apparition whose it may, it advances to the picture, seems to seize the frame, tries to peep behind it, and turns away with a frown as black as the ancestral one. The fantastic scene just hinted at must by no means be considered as forming an actual portion of our story. We were betrayed into this brief extravagance by the quiver of the moonbeams. They dance hand in hand with shadows, and are reflected in the looking-glass, which, you are aware, is always a kind of window or doorway into the spiritual world. We needed relief, moreover, from our too long and exclusive contemplation of that figure in the chair. This wild wind, too, has tossed our thoughts into strange confusion, but without tearing them away from their one determined center. Yonder leaden judge sits immovably upon our soul. Will he never stir again? We shall go mad unless he stirs. You may the better estimate his quietude by the fearlessness of a little mouse, which sits on its hind legs in a streak of moonlight, close by Judge Pyncheon's foot, and seems to meditate a journey of exploration over this great black bulk. Ha! What has startled the nimble little mouse? It is the visage of Grimalkin, outside of the window, where he appears to have posted himself for a deliberate watch. This Grimalkin has a very ugly look. Is it a cat watching for a mouse, or the devil for a human soul? Would we could scare him from the window. Thank heaven, the night is well nigh past. The moonbeams have no longer so silvery a gleam, nor contrast so strongly with the blackness of the shadows among which they fall. They are paler now. The shadows look gray, not black. The boisterous wind is hushed. What is the hour? Ah, the watch has at last ceased to tick, for the judge's forgetful fingers neglected to wind it up, as usual, at 10 o'clock, being half an hour or so before his ordinary bedtime, and it has run down for the first time in 5 years. But the great world-clock of time still keeps its beat. The dreary night, for oh, how dreary seems its haunted waste, behind us, gives place to a fresh, transparent, cloudless morn. Blessed, blessed radiance! The daybeam, even what little of it finds its way into this always dusky parlor, seems part of the universal benediction, annulling evil and rendering all goodness possible and happiness attainable. Will Judge Pyncheon now rise up from his chair? Will he go forth and receive the early sunbeams on his brow? Will he begin this new day, which God has smiled upon and blessed and given to mankind? Will he begin it with better purposes than the many that have been spent amiss? Or are all the deep-laid schemes of yesterday as stubborn in his heart and as busy in his brain as ever? In this latter case there is much to do. Will the judge still insist with Hepzibah on the interview with Clifford? Will he buy a safe, elderly gentleman's horse? Will he persuade the purchaser of the old Pyncheon property to relinquish the bargain in his favor? Will he see his family physician and obtain a medicine that shall preserve him to be an honor and blessing to his race until the utmost term of patriarchal longevity? Will Judge Pyncheon, above all, make due apologies to that company of honorable friends and satisfy them that his absence from the festive board was unavoidable, and so fully retrieve himself in their good opinion that he shall yet be governor of Massachusetts? And all these great purposes accomplished, will he walk the streets again with that dog-day smile of elaborate benevolence, sultry enough to tempt flies to come and buzz in it? Or will he, after the tomb-like seclusion of the past day and night, go forth a humbled and repentant man, sorrowful, gentle, seeking no profit, shrinking from worldly honor, hardly daring to love God, but bold to love his fellow man, and to do him what good he may? Will he bear about with him no odious grin of feigned benignity, insolent in its pretense and loathsome in its falsehood, but the tender sadness of a contrite heart, broken at last beneath its own weight of sin? For it is our belief, whatever show of honor he may have piled upon it, that there was heavy sin at the base of this man's being. Rise up, Judge Pyncheon. The morning sunshine glimmers through the foliage, and beautiful and holy as it is, shuns not to kindle up your face. Rise up, thou subtle, worldly, selfish, iron-hearted hypocrite, and make thy choice whether still to be subtle, worldly, selfish, iron-hearted, and hypocritical, or to tear these sins out of thy nature, though they bring the life-blood with them. The Avenger is upon thee. Rise up before it be too late. What? Thou art not stirred by this last appeal? No, not a jot. And there we see a fly, one of your common house-flies, such as are always buzzing on the window-pane, which has smelt out Governor Pyncheon, and alights, now on his forehead, now on his chin, and now, heaven help us, is creeping over the bridge of his nose, towards the would-be chief magistrate's wide-open eyes. Canst thou not brush the fly away? Art thou too sluggish, thou man, that hadst so many busy projects yesterday? Art thou too weak that wast so powerful? Not brush away a fly? Nay, then, we give thee up. And hark, the shop bell rings. After hours like these latter ones, through which we have borne our heavy tale, it is good to be made sensible that there is a living world, and that even this old, lonely mansion retains some manner of connection with it. We breathe more freely, emerging from Judge Pyncheon's presence into the street before the Seven Gables. End of chapter.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Aloe or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.